This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. I'm your host, David Brett.
It was July 1944, just a few months before the last shots were fired in World War II. At a secluded Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in the United States, 730 delegates from all 44 Allied nations gathered for a conference. The attendees, politicians, economists, and financial experts, among others, were attempting to establish a monetary and financial system that worked for all during the post-war period. They came up with the idea of gross domestic product, or GDP. It was supposed to be the ultimate measure of a country's overall welfare.
So GDP is probably one of the most famous concepts in macroeconomics as the measurement of an economy.
That's Pierre Sachdeva, an economist at Schroders. Keen not to make the same mistakes following the First World War, GDP became important. It was supposed to be the primary measure of economic success. And yet...
Most studies find that GDP itself actually has little link to markets in the short term. And equity markets in particular tend to respond to improvements in earnings and productivity.
And in today's globalised world, it's increasingly apparent that this Nobel-winning metric is too narrow for these troubled economic times, where perhaps too much value is placed upon economic success over social success, a problem that the pandemic has shone a light on. The problem with GDP is that it plays its part in propping up an economic system that incentivizes activity that depletes ecosystems and habitats crucial to human survival.
I think what's happening now is the realization that actually from a sustainability point of view, GDP is a monetary measure or value of an economy. And so it's effectively the same as saying money is what we value and value only. And ultimately, I think if we're thinking about profits with an ESG lens, then that naturally poses the question of whether we should be doing the same for a country.
So in this show, we'll look at whether GDP is still fit for purpose. We'll explore the importance of income and other social factors in happiness and their relationship with GDP. And we'll identify the risks that stem from ignoring well-being to the world economy and why it's so important to investors.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
One of the first tasks that I did when I joined Schroders about 5 years ago was to summarise a very long review on how GDP struggles to measure services and other elements of the economy. So to give an example, Facebook, obviously a well-known company, is only as valuable as the advertising revenue it generates in the national account.
Facebook up 7% in after-hours. The numbers crossed just there as Phil was chatting. And a big beat similar to Google, driven by advertising. Revenue coming in at $26.2 billion. Forecast was $23.7 billion. The advertising revenue at $25.4 billion. The forecast there was for $23 billion. So, as I said, driven...
Yet GDP struggles or fails to value free online goods such as social media, search engines, maps, videos and more, which, of course, is a major driver of the business models of some of the biggest companies in the world, like Facebook and Google. A study in 2019 by MIT tried to put a value on these tools. For instance, it said Facebook is worth about $40 to $50 per month for US consumers, according to a series of surveys the researchers conducted. In Europe, digital maps on phones are valued at €59, and the free messaging tool WhatsApp, used most widely outside the US, is worth a whopping €536 per month, the survey indicates. This might go some way to explaining why investors pay around 24 times the value of Facebook's price to earnings, but it's not something GDP accounts for.
So You know, GDP does struggle to measure parts of the modern economy, including services, things that we get for free, but also the gig economy as well.
Gig workers, so those with income earning activities outside of traditional long-term employer-employee relationships, such as independent contractors, are becoming a huge part of the economy, particularly since the pandemic. Even before COVID struck, as many as 55 million people in the United States were gig workers, or 34% of the workforce. That was back in 2019, according to the International Labour Organization. And the total was projected to rise to 43% in 2020. That's potentially millions being unaccounted for by GDP.
So GDP is a bit old school.
This is by no means the first time GDP as a single measure of a country's prosperity has been called into question. Even the creator of modern GDP theory, Simon Kuznets, an economist at the National Bureau of Economic Research, warned against its use as a measure of welfare in his report to US Congress back in 1937. Then in the early 1970s, the then King of Bhutan declared his aim was not to increase GDP, but GNH, gross national happiness.
So we can think about well-being as, you know, we can use it interchangeably with happiness.
Pia says she kept a diary during the 2020 lockdowns. Every day she'd write down three things she appreciated in her life. It allowed her to reflect on what made her happy, and a major theme emerged. While she was exceptionally grateful for job security during the pandemic, what made her happy tended to be the things that money can't buy. And that went against everything she'd been taught in her career as an economist, where GDP as a monetary value of an economy is the main measure of societal performance. In other words, Pia should only have been as happy as the material things she owned. Yet, her diary proved otherwise. And there are certainly risks to the economy and markets if societal performance is ignored. You only have to look at the Greek debt crisis in 2015 to see the real consequences of societal failure.
Chaos erupting in Greece. Thousands of anti-austerity protesters clashing with police in Athens over the country's debt crisis. This after the government passed reform.
Greek banks are going to be closed for a week. The stock exchange closed at least Monday, and the Greek government has imposed something called capital controls. That limits how much money individuals can withdraw from their accounts. We are hearing that maybe as little as $66 a day per account. This also means Greece will probably not make its payment due to the IMF on Tuesday. That means it will be in technical default.
Markets open Monday morning. What happens?
I don't think it looks very good. Right now in early trading, we know the euro's lower. I think there'll be pressure on stocks. But as the hours emerge, we'll know more information. This is going to be a critical.
So it's no coincidence that the idea to consider well-being as a measure of societal performance has been accompanied by the rise of investors considering social factors in their decision making. But measuring well-being or happiness as an investor has always felt a bit, well, wishy-washy. But Pia says it can be done.
There are a few measures of happiness, and the main one used in the well-being literature is actually a subjective measure. So it's well-being as measured by a survey question that asks people how happy they are on a scale of 0 to 10, and that's called the central ladder technique. And interestingly, that data is actually quite stable over time. And I'd also highlight that because of the shift to thinking about well-being, there are many objective well-being measures too that have now, you know, we now get fairly sort of easily access to. And that includes loads of data sets like things on housing, income, education, health and safety. So there's both a subjective measure and the objective.
Ultimately, it's a subjective measure we as investors are interested in, and its relationship with GDP is what we'll discuss in part two.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website schroeders.com/investor-download.
To flip an old saying on its head, money can buy happiness, but only to a point. As GDP is the conventional measure for economic performance, it is a natural starting point to understand the relationship between GDP growth and happiness. Does money make us happier? If GDP were to have little relationship with happiness, an explicit pursuit of higher well-being could have major implications for economic policy, growth, and financial markets. However, if societal goals changed, governments would likely have to change economic incentives via policy levers to shift resources towards certain areas of the economy. This could also have a detrimental impact to government deficits, as spending generates less income than before, though in the long run, happier workers should be more productive.
So I think, interestingly, there aren't many behavioural models around exactly what makes people happy. So just to sort of to give an example, like, we know that if you give someone money, it doesn't make them happy because you handed them cash, let's say. It makes them happy because they can buy things with it. So without proposing a behavioural model, we can still look at the statistical relationship between the two. And when we look at this, GDP, or that's equivalent in an economic perspective to income or income per person. Income per person explains roughly half the differences in happiness across countries. And when we include unemployment, which we know has a relationship with GDP, this rises to 60%. So income and unemployment do play a part in happiness.
So GDP can, in some part, act as a measure of happiness or well-being. But how direct is that relationship between well-being and GDP?
So I think potentially this isn't a surprise. You know, the relationship is not a linear one. It's not one for one. As society gets richer, the smaller the boost is from getting more income. And in terms of that means, from a macro perspective, income is essentially a better proxy for happiness in poorer countries like the frontier and emerging markets than it is for richer countries and developed markets. And from a policy perspective, any pursuit of happiness or pursuit of well-being from governments is likely to be accompanied by measures to reduce inequality. And so these policy measures could be things like higher taxes.
As a permanent additional investment in health and social care, it would be irresponsible to meet the costs from higher borrowing and higher debt. From next April, we will create a new UK-wide 1.25% health and social care levy on earned income hypothecated in law to health and social care, with dividend rates increasing by the same amount.
But also higher minimum wage.
Just got some news a short time ago, President Biden asking his administration to prepare a potential executive order that would make federal contractors offer their workers a $15 minimum wage.
Many economists, like Treasury Secretary nominee Janet Yellen, who was originally a labor economist, they've seized on several studies showing a rise in the minimum wage does not cause employers to shed workers.
But that's only part of the story, or 60%, as Pierre says. What else matters?
So when we look across all those objective well-being measures that I spoke about before, we find that if you consider income and unemployment, that explains roughly 60% of the variation of happiness across countries. But when we add in health and perceived corruption, that takes the amount explained up to around 90%. And I think as economists and investors, you know, we think about income and unemployment a lot, but essentially this is saying that we should also be thinking about physical health, mental health, and corruption, which tends to erode social trust or the social fabric of society and what we can think about as being social capital.
So we shouldn't just forget about GDP.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'm saying that while we can do better, GDP, especially when paired with unemployment, actually does a relatively good job in capturing well-being. And that's better for EM, emerging markets, than DM, developed markets. But if governments were to focus on well-being in the future, that then doesn't mean throwing the current framework out of the window. But it may mean spending more on health and potentially reducing inequality as well to improve that perceived corruption.
Which may well have an impact on markets and investors. And that's what's coming up in the final part of the show.
So in usual times, there is little link between markets and well-being. And I think for investors, that's probably not particularly surprising. Most studies find that GDP itself actually has little link to markets in the short term, and equity markets in particular tend to respond to improvements in earnings and productivity.
So why should investors care?
So that's in usual times, but of course investors have to think about unusual times too. Historically, there are quite a few examples of where unhappiness in society has weighed on financial markets. And in most cases, disillusionment caused by low standards of well-being has led to populist governments. So that's the main channel by which happiness can impact investors. Most examples of this have been in emerging markets and the frontier world as well. But just to name, if in 2010, we had the Arab Spring.
In the barren fields just outside Sidi Bouzid lies the body of 26-year-old Mohamed Bouazizi. Mohamed, frustrated and ashamed by the public humiliation he endured at the hands of police, set himself on fire outside the local municipality building. His closest friends, anguished by Mohamed's actions, took to the streets and began a popular uprising that lasted for weeks before it toppled the 23-year-old rule of President Zine Abidine Ben Ali.
In 2015, we had the Greek crisis. And more recently, in 2019, we've had a series of protests in Latin America.
A wave of political and social unrest is sweeping South America. Venezuela has already been in turmoil for years. But in the last 4 months, presumably stable countries have erupted, leaving death, anger, and political instability in their wake.
So all of these had consequences for financial markets. In these examples, I can point to the oil price in the case of the Arab Spring and various currency movements when it comes to the Greek crisis, which clearly weighed on the euro. And we've seen some idiosyncratic risk in EMFX from these protests in LATAM. So from this perspective, investors should consider risks from unhappy markets, but not necessarily seek return from happy markets. So ultimately, from a top-down or multi-asset perspective, I think our research supports focusing the ESG lens on the E and the G, so the environment and governance, but also keeping an eye on risks from S. And that's for a couple of reasons. So I think the first is that governance does seem to underpin social. If we think about well-being being a macro measure of the social side of things, and corruption being a measure of governance, we're finding that corruption actually helps to determine a country happiness does suggest that S is at least partly driven by G. And also health spending is also determined by governments. So essentially a good social outcome is a reflection of good governance. And so that poses the question of whether sort of G should come above S when we're thinking about ESG. The second reason is that just as GDP growth rates don't explain market performance, social factors don't usually impact markets either, particularly at a country level. And that's in contrast to the company level. So this would be very different for stock pickers. And I guess the final thing to say is that's not to say that happiness is not important, and unhappiness can actually give us hints of when there is upcoming social unrest and political change. And ultimately that can pose a risk to markets and, something that investors should be thinking about.
Here's what else investors are talking about. Last year, as the pandemic unfolded, UK equities were among the worst affected equity markets globally. At the time, Schroders believed the Great British sell-off would eventually attract international interest, particularly when the Brexit overhang was removed. This dynamic has indeed materialised. UK companies have shrugged off the gloom of recent years and have become the target of considerable interest from international buyers. Meanwhile, the surge of new listings shows no sign of abating, according to Rory Bateman, head of equities at Schroders. You can read Rory's article, Why is the UK Investment Climate So Hot Right Now, at schroders.com/insights, where you can read, watch and listen to much, much more. Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, check out our website, schroders.com/theinvestor download. You can also get in contact with us about anything in the show or ideas for future shows at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. Please remember to subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. We're now doing one show a week, which will be available every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. Thanks very much for listening, but above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.